Good afternoon.
Got quiet in a hurry, didn't it?
Okay. Some of you are aware, I'm a member of the program committee of the Forum Club, and when we talk about getting people from different segments of the economy to come in and speak, we usually have one or two speakers from the financial world. You know, in the past, we've had Jamie Dimon, we've had Richard Dimon from Barclays, we've had Pandit from Citicorp, thanks to Mike Armstrong. I know Mike's here. And I suggested that perhaps we ought to look at a different kind of banker for this year. And that's a banker who's also an entrepreneur. How many entrepreneurs in this room? Raise your hand. Yeah, right. So we all have some interest in what he has to say about investing his own capital as opposed to shareholders' capital. Okay, they gave me a bio on Chris. I've known him since 1991, and there's a lot of things that I can't say about him that are not on this sheet. So, but I will tell you a little bit about what the sheet says, and then we'll go from there. I might also comment that I've known Chris since 1991. That's when we started working together. He was a little younger then, and I was a lot younger then. I got to tell you, this young man has one of the most brilliant banking minds I have ever worked with. And those of you that know him, I know, will share those sentiments. Chris is chairman and CEO of J.C. Flowers & Company, and it's founded in 1998. It's an investment firm specializing in financial services, which means banks, insurance companies, and et cetera. And he has investments largely in the U.S., Japan, and Europe in banking, insurance, and in finance. And they have committed capital over $10 billion. These are private funds, not government funds, private funds. Previously, Chris was head of the Financial Institutions Group at Goldman Sachs, and that was a position he held when I first became acquainted with him. He joined Goldman Sachs in 1979 in the M&A department of banking, and he was among the founders of Goldman's Financial Institutions Group in 1986 and became a general partner of Goldman in 1988. He also served on Goldman's operating committee, and then he left in 1998 to form his own company, the company he has now. He does also some civic work. He's chairman of a group called Nets for Life, and it's a program aimed at reducing malaria. He's a trustee of the New York Philharmonic Orchestra, and Chris is a member of the investment committee of St. James Church in New York and on various committees associated with Harvard University. And I'll tell you something really scary about Chris. He graduated with highest honors in applied mathematics from Harvard in 1979. So to me, I guess I'm a number. To him, I'm a number, right? Also, Chris was a leader in the Young Republican group at Harvard, which is sort of an oxymoron. he didn't know I knew that about him, so I... Also, Chris was a major player. Some of you may know this. Was a major player when he was at Goldman, in putting together Nations Bank and Bank of America, which is now Bank of America. He was a major player in the takeover of Wells Fargo by Norwest. And somebody said, so you people are going to say, who was Norwest? Well, Norwest was very profitable and was lucky to be able to use Wells Fargo's name. So that's the answer to that question, if you have it. He also played a major role as a major investor in restructuring and initiated the resurrection of the Long-Term Credit Bank of Japan. How many of you remember that bank? Long-Term Credit Bank of Japan, which went under with a lot of bad loans. He resurrected it and did an IPO on it. It's now among the top 10 banks in Japan, maybe the only one controlled by foreign interests. Chris, is that right?
Pretty close.
Close. Okay, and the name of that bank is called Shinsei, which means in Japanese reborn. So it's a reborn bank. He's played a major role in also the restructuring and the purchasing of many financial institutions and the hundreds of millions of dollars and even the billions and billions of dollars. As I said before, I've known Chris since 1991 and been able to maintain a relationship with him up to and including the fall of 2008. And how many remember the fall of 2008? Okay. Well, Chris was involved with Bear Stearns. He was involved with Lehman Brothers. He may talk about that a little bit. He was involved with a little bit with AIG behind the scenes. He understands derivatives. I think he may have invented the word. He understands it, I guess, because of his math background. He also has acquired a banking company in California called the IndyMac Bank, which was now the One West Bank in California. And this was probably the result of the major government mistake in subprime mortgage lending, and was the start of what we had in 2008. I think most of you probably would agree with that. And I told Chris when he agreed to come, I said, you're going to speak to a friendly audience. Chris is a Republican, and I'm going to guess 95% of this group is Republican and conservative. And how many are investors, by the way? Hold your hand up. Okay, so you have a lot of interest, Chris. So with that, I'd like to introduce my good friend, and as I said, one of the most brilliant banking minds I've ever met, J. Christopher Flowers. J.C. Flowers.
Thank you very much, Malcolm, for that nice introduction. I had forgotten myself I was a member of the Young Republican Club of Harvard till Malcolm reminded me, and I don't know where you found that. I was by myself, by the way. I was the only young Republican at Harvard. Now I'm an old Republican instead of a young Republican. Thank you all for having me today here in Naples. Malcolm tells me the weather is like this every day, and I believe everything Malcolm tells me, so maybe we'll move down here to the land of no taxes instead of New York. Let me say one thing, if I may, at the outset, which is I'm not a stock picker, so I don't know what stocks to buy. Our company, as I'll explain in a minute, is in the private equity business, so we do buy and sell companies, but not in the stock market itself. But what I am going to try to do is give you a little bit of my perspective on what's going on in the financial services market, in the economy around the world today, at least from our perspective. And then I'm also going to talk about, before that for a minute, the Lehman Brothers weekend, my experience of that, what do I think was going on there, and what that means today, or what the implications are for that today. Just a word about our company. J.C. Flowers & Co. invests only in financial services. We're the largest private equity company in the world, which specializes in this area. We have $10 billion of equity invested. We have 24 investments around the world, which include direct or indirect stakes in 10 banks in the U.S., the U.K., the Netherlands, Germany, Russia, India, China, Japan, and Taiwan. And so we have a pretty good spread or feeling for the banking market and the economy in different parts of the world. We also have investments in insurance companies, finance companies, and securities firms. And just for an example, the most recent investment we've made is we joined with the China Investment Corporation, the Government Investment Corporation of Singapore, and some other investments to buy a stake in a company called Pactual, which is the largest investment bank in the emerging markets based in Sao Paulo and Rio de Janeiro in Brazil. I've specialized in financial services for 30 years, as Malcolm mentioned, first at Goldman Sachs, and then on my own. I set up my own company in 1998. And for most of those 30 years, this has been an excellent strategy, yielding much fun and lots of profits. However, in 2008, it was not like that at all, and we took quite a beating, and I witnessed absolutely astounding financial carnage on all sides firsthand. Happily, our fortunes have improved somewhat since then, but I thought it might interest you all if I said a few words about some of my experiences during the crisis. And I'm just going to focus for a couple minutes on that weekend when Lehman went bankrupt, which, by the way, was Sunday, September 14th, 2008. So my own personal experience of this was I was in Japan at our bank, Shinsei Bank in Japan, at a board meeting on Wednesday. This is the Wednesday before Sunday. I had a call from Ken Lewis, CEO of the Bank of America, and he said, I'd like to come back to America, and I want you to come back right now, because we are thinking about buying Lehman Brothers, and we would like you to be partners with us in this endeavor. And the idea was that they get the good stuff, and we get the bad stuff. That was the idea. And we said, yes, of course, you know, that's the business we're in. I returned to America Wednesday night, and starting on Thursday morning at 7 a.m., I was at the law firm Sullivan & Cromwell in Midtown Manhattan with lots of other people and Lehman Brothers and so forth, Bank of America, and we started looking at the books of Lehman Brothers, which, by the way, were a very sorry sight indeed. And they made Bear Stearns, which we had looked at a few months earlier, look good. So there I was on Thursday thinking this is shaping up to be a busy weekend, and on Thursday night I had a call from Bob Willemstad, who at that time was the CEO of AIG. And I said, hello, Bob. And he said, I would like to see you tomorrow immediately. We have some problems down here at AIG. I said, this is shaping up to be a busy weekend. And so on Friday, as we worked away on Lehman Brothers, I went down to AIG at 70 Pine Street in Lower Manhattan and had lunch with Bob Willemstad and several other people. And they gave me a piece of paper, which I have framed on my wall. This thing is fantastic. It's the kind of thing you might have in your own home. And it was AIG parent company cash flow. And it said Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, like that, you know, like that. And then Wednesday was negative $5 billion. And a week later was something like negative $25 billion, something like that. And I said something about bankruptcy to them. There were several people there. And somebody said, well, let's not get alarmist. You know, don't go crazy. And I said, yeah, okay, fine. But, you know, if you don't pay people $5 billion on Wednesday, we don't have to use the word bankruptcy, but they're going to be really, really upset. You know, and right then and there, we call Warren Buffett right there from that room because they hadn't talked to Warren Buffett yet. And we talked about him, blah, blah, blah. And then later, Warren called me back. He said, these guys seem really dumb to me. Do they seem dumb to you? However, what we did is we thought AIG might be an opportunity. And so I called our friends at Allianz. And for those of you who don't know, Allianz, it's the biggest insurance company in Europe. It's almost as big as maybe it's the biggest insurance company in the world now. I don't know. But we had close ties with Allianz. And we sent a plane to get somebody from Allianz, and we said, you got to get here, and you got to get here right now. And so we teamed up with Allianz and started looking at making an investment in AIG. And so then, as if that we didn't have enough going on. And by the way, on Friday night, I talked to Hank Paulson, and I know Hank Paulson well because we were both at Goldman Sachs together for many years. And he, of course, was the Secretary of the Treasury at that time. And he said, we knew already that the Lehman was impossible unless we had some kind of government support. And so we talked to Hank and said, we're only going to do this with government support. And he said, well, we can't give you any government support. So, you know, and by the way, I will say that the authorities conducted themselves with professionalism, and I'll give you my assessment of that in a minute. But, I mean, these were not easy circumstances that Hank and a lot of other people found themselves in. But he said, we're not going to offer any government assistance on Lehman. So Saturday morning, I get over to Wachtell Lipton, another law firm in New York that's representing the Bank of America, and Ken Lewis says, I got a call from John Thain. I want to buy Merrill Lynch. Forget Lehman. Let's go buy Merrill Lynch. Can you help us with that? And so at this point, this was the most unusual weekend of my entire business career. So we got a third team working on Merrill. And then we went down the Treasury, actually not the Treasury, sorry, the Federal Reserve. We went down the Federal Reserve downtown, and I met with Hank, and we talked about Lehman for a while. And then after it was over, I said, Hank, I want to talk to you about something. And so it was just me and him, and I showed him this piece of paper that I mentioned. It was AIG's cash flow. And I said, have you looked at this thing? Are you paying attention to AIG? And he said, oh, my God. That's what he said. I was there. And and I will say, it wasn't like they didn't know there were problems at AIG, because they did. But I don't think that they had so much task overload going on at the Federal Reserve and the Treasury that they weren't really focused on AIG yet. So In the course of the weekend, I mean, everybody knows how this all turned out. We, on Sunday, teamed up with Allianz, you know, the China Investment Corporation, which is the state investment fund of China, and we offered to put $10 billion into AIG on Sunday. And we proposed buying $10 billion worth of stock at $2 a share. And I remember talking to Bob Willemstad about it on that Sunday, and he was deeply offended by the idea that we were only offering $2 a share. So you can judge for yourself. Yeah, but we were lucky that he was offended, I think. And, you know, kind of where this all ended up is I remember Sunday, it was a beautiful Sunday night, Lehman was on the way down, and everybody knew that. And I had nothing to do at that point. I was sort of hanging around AIG downtown, and the Federal Reserve was right up the street. So I took a walk up Wall Street, you know, like right out of the movies, and there was a church at one end and a graveyard at the other. And I remember calling, I called Jamie Dimon, and he said, you know, I think you really pissed off Bob Willemstad. it was really quite an amazing experience. What I would offer to you as a, my own observation about this would be something like this. In retrospect, if you ask me to bail out some companies and not bail out others, let Lehman go down, bail out AIG, et cetera, was very confusing to the market, and there was not really a pattern to that, which I think makes sense. And I think that that in retrospect, the government probably would have been better off propping up Lehman as well and not letting the complete carnage ensue, which we saw afterwards. So I think they made a mistake. That's what I think. Having said that, I would also say a couple things. Number one, a lot of smart people, I think, did not foresee just how bad this was going to be. And I have to say, I was standing right there. I knew Lehman was going bankrupt, et cetera, and I myself did not fully appreciate just how bad it was going to be. And I don't think Hank Paulson did, and I don't think very many people realized how bad it was going to be. And my point is, I think it was not so easy to fully appreciate how bad this was going to get. And secondly, you know, I'm not sure I could have done any better because there were so many decisions to make so fast, so much going on, so complicated that it was not at all an easy environment to get everything right. So on the whole, I think in retrospect, some things might have been done different and better. But on the other hand, I'm not sure I could have done a better job myself if it had been up to me. Let me turn from that to the topic of regulatory reform that we've seen as a result of this crisis. Governments, as you know, have made regulatory changes as a result of this crisis. But if I may quote a partner in our company, we have a partner in our company named Callum McCarthy, who was formerly the head of the FSA in Britain. So he was the head of all the regulatory stuff in Britain, including, by the way, when Lehman went bankrupt. And as he said, we have a strange mix of the irrelevant, the useful, and unimportant issues remaining unaddressed in this regulatory reform. So to take one sort of trivial example, does it make the world a better place to have the regulators and the politicians get involved in compensation? No, it doesn't. Of course, it's easy to understand, you know, the politics of that. But as shareholders, we don't need the government's help figuring out how much to pay people. We have no particular interest as shareholders in paying people too much. If it was easy to get compensation right, you know, everybody would be doing it. It's not so easy. And one of the weird things about this is the whole point about variable compensation, which is being discouraged by the authorities, is that you can match that more easily to performance. And weirdly, we're being sort of pushed towards having greater fixed compensation, less variable compensation, which is the opposite of what actually makes sense. So there's one example where, it's not that big an issue, but the is really sort of irrelevant. Another one is corporate governance. There's been much talk about improving corporate governance, et cetera. The truth of the matter is that corporate governance had nothing to do with the problems that we just had. You had banks with fantastic boards, with the high and the mighty, and the et cetera, that did disastrously. You had boards paying no attention, but, you know, where the companies did great. It really makes no difference, and reforming it will make no difference either. The bottom line of this is if you have a CEO who knows what he's doing, that is the place to start. And the board can't, picking the CEO is their basic job, and if they do that right, the rest will follow. Yet another example is the Volcker rules and the related points about whether banks can engage in private equity and hedge funds and that kind of thing. And here we have a solution to a problem that doesn't exist. Hedge funds and private equity really had nothing to do with the crisis we just had. The crisis emanated from the heart of the regulated part of the financial services, and restricting that will make no difference to anything. One thing that I do think is sensible and is a step in the right direction are the new Basel III rules for banks, and the essence of that is that they will require higher capital ratios. I personally think that makes sense. Our own experience in this crisis, we, as I mentioned, have lots of banks. The banks with the not very brilliant observation, the banks with stronger capital bases did much better, and the banks with a weak capital base took much more of a beating. That's common sense, and I think that does make sense. What the new Basel rules will provide for. And by the way, this is especially true outside the United States. In general, the American banking system is much better capitalized than other parts of the world, and so it's partly about the rest of the world catching up to the United States in this particular respect. Although one thing that certainly will happen as a result of this, and I see it everywhere, including in banks that we own and banks that we're not involved with but we're observing, are people pulling in their balance sheets, pulling back credit, reducing, getting rid of the lazy part of the balance sheet, et cetera, and that is going to restrict to some degree the availability of credit and to some degree make the recovery in Europe, for example, slower than it otherwise would have been. And another thing in the unaddressed department is, if you ask me, if we have another crisis like Lehman Brothers, it's going to be just as bad as last time. These big companies, as you all know, are global. They are just a spaghetti mess of stuff all over the place, and nothing anybody has done is going to make the next too big to fail thing any better than Lehman Brothers was last time. And by the way, we're always going to have financial institutions that are too big to fail. There is not a solution making them not too big to fail. And so that's a problem that remains unaddressed. Let me talk a little bit about what I think is going on in the U.S. economy. Let me start by saying that we find America the single most attractive market in the world. For all the problems and deficiencies of this country, it really has a lot going for it. For one thing, the U.S. has excellent demographics, among the best of any big country. It has a gigantic and highly sophisticated financial services market and an outstanding business environment. It has a level of entrepreneurial dynamism which is really unrivaled anywhere. And for example, there's a really palpable contrast between Europe and the United States in the level of entrepreneurial energy that we see. And from our perspective, there continues to be a fair amount of distress in this economy, and that kind of distress offers opportunities to investors like us. I think that U.S. banks are making progress, but they still have a ways to go. And as many of you undoubtedly know, almost all banks everywhere are heavily exposed to real estate, especially Main Street banks. And to give you a statistic, as of September 30th, 57% of U.S. banks' balance sheets was related to real estate, of which 37% was residential real estate and 20% is commercial real estate. And that's kind of the way it is everywhere in the world. Obviously, there are big disparities among American banking institutions, which explains why some are prospering and some are faltering. But most banks still have some overhang from both residential and commercial real estate, including residential second mortgages. And just to elaborate on that, U.S. house prices are still falling sort of gently. The backlog of foreclosed property is continuing to go up, which puts pressure on house prices. In the short run, this is going to get worse as the mortgage fiasco, the robo-signing, you know, all that stuff gets behind and people start foreclosing again with energy. And just to give you one statistic, the elapsed time from 60 days delinquent to foreclosure sale for prime mortgages has gone up from about 13 months to 16 months in the last couple of years, showing the prolongation of this whole process. So my whole point about this is, for a while, we still have more real estate coming onto the market, which will keep pressure, downward pressure on houses. Meanwhile, on commercial real estate, we also still have a big overhang. And that's a lagging sector as leases come due and loans come due and so forth. And so I expect a lot of pressure in commercial real estate as well. We expect to see significant continued capital raising by U.S. banks, which in some cases offers opportunities to investors like us. And the trick for us in these bank recaps is to find a bank that needs additional capital, but where the public markets can't provide the solution, and yet where the franchise is good enough and the problem assets are manageable. So, all the stars come into alignment. And we've looked at many of these deals, but we haven't seen the Goldilocks deal yet. But one of these days, maybe we'll see a bank that we think is worth recapping. As Malcolm mentioned, we've done FDIC deals. We bought IndyMac from the FDIC. We bought it, I remember working out on Christmas Eve 2008 when things were just as bleak as they could be. I wasn't in a very good mood myself in December Eve 2008. As a result, as is often the case, there was nobody on the planet Earth that would buy IndyMac. And so the FDIC had only one choice, and that was us. And as a result, that particular deal, turned out to be an excellent deal. So we did that deal with the FDIC. It's been renamed One West, headquartered in Los Angeles. One West went on to buy two more companies from the FDIC. The way these deals work is the FDIC protects the investors against asset problems in the bank, so we don't have any asset problems at One West Bank. And so that's turned out very well. The FDIC continues to do deals. We think there will be several hundred more FDIC-assisted deals in the next couple of years. The FDIC provides information on the number of problem institutions that they're following. And they don't give the names, but they give the numbers. And as of the most recent list in September, there were 860 banks on the FDIC problem list with total assets of about $400 billion. And we do our own calculations and come up with similar numbers. And out of this group of 860, probably 200 or 300 will get taken over by the FDIC in the next couple of years. Let me say a word about Europe, where we think there are a lot of interesting things to think about. Well, let me start by saying that we think the euro will hold together and that there will be no cataclysmic sovereign defaults in Europe. That doesn't mean that in Greece or Ireland, for example, that we will not have extensions, prolongations, and similar kind of concessions that have to be given by debt holders. But I don't think, where the rubber really meets the road on this is Spain going to default? That is where it meets the road, because Spain is big. And if Spain were to default or leave the euro, or if Germany left the euro, leaving Spain behind, et cetera, the results would be utterly cataclysmic. Words cannot describe how bad that would be. It would make Lehman Brothers look like a little gentle rain, and now we are in a hurricane. And, you know, just to give you one example, you know, there are two gigantic Spanish banks, Santander and BBVA. They wouldn't be able to borrow any money from anybody. And so you'd have the whole same liquidity freeze, only 10 times worse, as we had when Lehman went bankrupt. And so I don't think the euro is going to fall apart, because it can't fall apart. And by the way, it's also not in the interest of the Germans, among other reasons, for all the reasons I just said. But in addition, having Germany in the euro keeps their currency low, which helps exports, which helps the economy, et cetera. So I see the euro hanging together. I do not see any big countries defaulting. And so we base our investment plans on that point of view. We'll find out if that's right. But that's our point of view. For us right now, I won't spend a ton of time on this, but I will just say that Spain is an area of considerable interest to us. As I've said, we expect Spain to make good on its obligations. There's a huge real estate overhang in Spain. It's sort of like Nevada. You know, the whole country is like Las Vegas, basically, in terms of real estate. And the Spanish government is taking energetic action to try to fix this problem. They've just put in new higher capital ratios for their banks. The Spanish government is sort of taking an FDIC-like stance where they're offering capital both to investors like us and to their banks, sort of like TARP, to shore up the system. They've told their banks they have to be recapitalized by September 30th, 2011. It is now February 18th. They said, everybody, you got to get this done by September 30th of this year, and there is no way in the world that everybody's going to get this job done by September 30th, which means that people offering private capital you know, should have good opportunities in a place like Spain. Another problem that the Eurozone has is a reliance on wholesale funding. So just to explain this, if you look at the average bank balance sheet in the Eurozone, 32% of its assets are funded with retail deposits. In America, that number is 58%. In Japan, that's 64%. So, you know, people going into branches and putting money in is only one-third of the capital needed to finance the balance sheet of banks in Europe. Where does the rest of it come from? Well, a lot of it was from wholesale funding, from big institutions lending money to banks, and that money is running away. It's running away in Spain. It's running away in Italy. It's running away in Ireland. And as that gets sucked out of the system, it's causing a lot of stress. And some of that slack has been filled up by the European Central Bank, which I don't know, hopefully you all don't have to pay attention to stuff like this, but I noticed today that borrowings from the European Central Bank went up sharply in the last week. It was just announced yesterday. But that's not a long-term solution. And what this has resulted in many markets in Europe is a huge war for retail deposits. So all these banks are fighting to grab this 32% share of retail deposits, driving up retail interest rates and hurting interest spreads between assets and liabilities in Europe. So that's another challenge that Europe's got to get through. Whereas in the U.S., for example, or Japan, another place where we're very active, they're awash in deposits. They have more cash than they know what to do with. So that is quite a different feel between the U.S. and Japan and Europe. Let me say a word or two about China. So the big picture from our point of view, which is obvious, is that China is a huge opportunity. And you just have to do the math. You know, there's a lot of people in China. And sooner or later, they're going to have a bigger economy than we're going to have. You know, it's just a matter of time. And I'd like to just go back slightly in history on China and point out that this is not by any means the first time or the last time that China is going to be an interesting opportunity for American businessmen with a keen eye. And I went back and looked, and I will quote to you the following. 200 years ago, just about the most profitable thing you could do was to be in the maritime trade, trading between New York and Boston and China. I have here the statistics from the ship Pearl from Boston out to China and back in 1810. The investors put up $40,000. They made over $200,000 with an IRR over 100%, making six times their money. So this is the kind of deal that we would like to keep seeing in China. And by the way, no taxes either. And in those days, by the way, the richest person in the world was a Chinese merchant named Hu Kuo, who was kind of the guy you went to in China when you were trading with China. And at that time, the GDP of China was 10 times the United States and bigger than the entire British Empire. So this Chinese situation has been around for a long time. And I would also just, as a slight footnote, observe that one topic in the news with China is the issue of intellectual property. The British, in the 1840s, did a fantastic international property theft from China because at that time all the tea came from China. The British went in and stole it and started cultivating in India and made tons and tons of money. So when we look at China today, the big picture, of course, is it's a big deal. When we look at it in granular detail, and we've looked at many deals in China, we are concerned about credit quality. We're concerned about real estate prices. Just to give you one example, if you look at the growth of the Chinese banking system in the last 2 years, from the end of 2008 to the end of 2010, total assets of Chinese banks grew 65%, adding over $3 trillion of loans. And for those of you bankers in the room, and this is my own experience, you cannot grow 65% in 2 years, making $3 trillion of loans, and not make a whole lot of mistakes. And by the way, this is in a country with no credit culture, no bankruptcy laws, no nothing. And so, right now, like the United States, you know, in the mid 2010s, it's all covered up by a fantastic market, and everything's going up, and so on and so forth. But sooner or later, one way or another, the bad debts which are inherent in the Chinese marketplace, you know, we're going to come to a bad end. And I'm not saying at all that China is an interesting, attractive, a place people like us need to be, because it is. But I also think that substantial caution is warranted. Last time I was in Shanghai, I was had dinner with real estate moguls and what have you in Shanghai, and they were explaining to me that there is no limit to how much Shanghai real estate can be worth, because there is a limited amount of it. Okay, there's a limited amount. Okay, you judge for yourself what you think about that. So I think maybe with that I will close my remarks, and I'll be happy to answer some questions. Okay, thank you. All right, so you take the floor.
All right, thanks, Chris. You speak very interestingly about 2008 and 2009. What do you think should be done about the government's current deficit? Budget deficit.
Ah, well,
and it will send you to Washington.
Right, right. That's very simple. Which is, if we keep having budget deficits this big, we're going to go broke, and so therefore we have to cut that deficit down to a size that's going to work. And it's basically that simple. Things that, you know, is no more to it than that.
Okay, great. Mm-hmm. Here's a question with a little different slant. What do you think about losing control of the New York Stock Exchange through their merger?
I think that's splendid. I think if the Germans would like the New York Stock Exchange, they're welcome to it. And when they're tired of it, let us buy it back for less. The same strategy we used, remember when the Japanese bought Rockefeller Center?
Yeah, right.
And then we bought it back for less.
That's right.
That's what I think.
You think that B of A overpaid for Merrill Lynch?
This is a topic near and dear to my heart. I was at the – so when they paid what was seen by some at the time, is it depends how you look at it. On the one hand, first of all, they paid with stock. Let's start with that. So they didn't pay with cash. They paid with stock. So the question was, what's the relative exchange ratio between the two stocks? The exchange ratio they paid was the lowest – that it prevailed between the B of A and Merrill in the last 20 years. So in other words, if you looked at where it had been, came way down, and they paid quite a low exchange ratio. I remember being asked at the B of A board meeting that Sunday night, could we have got this thing, can we get it for less? Maybe. Maybe they could have got it for less. On the other hand, maybe if they didn't act then, somebody else would have bought it. Maybe if they didn't act then, Merrill would have gone bankrupt too, bringing down a lot of other house of cards with it, including not so good for the Bank of America itself. And I had long felt and feel today that it was an excellent strategic fit for the B of A, and is already proving to be a good acquisition.
Another question that's been floating around in the Wall Street Journal and other economic publications, is there any danger of the dollar being replaced as the world's reserve currency?
I think it's inevitable that the dollar's position as the world currency will erode over time. And, you know, one of these days, if the Chinese ever let the renminbi loose and it becomes a real convertible currency, the renminbi will have a place. The euro has not had a good few years, but if they have 5 or 10 years of stability, I can see the euro being an important currency. I will say, in this crisis, we had banks all over the place, and it made a huge difference to have one country, one currency, one central bank. Europe was a mess because they had all these countries and just a big – and I think people saw that. It'll take a while for the euro to can't claim a place there.
Okay. If you had a choice, would you keep your money in the U.S. or would you go to another emerging market?
Well, if I had to only pick one country in the world, which we don't because we're invested all over the place, the USA would be first on the list. People have been underestimating us since 1776.
This is a question that I didn't write this question, by the way, although we've talked about it. Congress mandated that banks have a 13% of their mortgages with homeowners who could not pay it back. Your comment?
Is that right? Did Congress say that?
Yes.
That sounds like a terrible idea.
Yeah. Remember Bill Clinton and Bob Rubin?
Yeah, I remember them. Yeah, Bob. He was at Goldman Sachs too, Bob Rubin.
Yeah, he was.
You don't want to comment on that, I guess. Okay. Hank Paulson commented on you in his book. I didn't know that. You have a comment on that?
It was too big to read. What did he say?
I don't know.
Okay. There's been some recent concern about inflation rates and interest rates. We have seen some firming of inflation rates, although the government doesn't want to admit it because they exclude food and fuel, which are two major items. What's your view on inflation in this country in the near term and then maybe over the next 5 to 10 years?
My view is it's sort of like I voted against it before I voted for it or whatever that thing was. You remember that? First we're going to have inflation and then we're going to have deflation, or else first we're going to have deflation and then we're going to have inflation. I don't think that, frankly, it's clear what the answer to that is. It's not clear to me anyway. And I look at Japan, where you had a tremendous amount of, we were very active. You had lots and lots of money flooding into that economy, just like the Federal Reserve has done here. And yet that has not resulted in inflation in Japan. I guess if I had to bet between inflation and deflation in this country, if I had to pick one, I would bet on inflation. I think in the next 5 years we're probably going to see some inflationary pressures would be my guess.
Okay. Sort of a non-business question, but a personal question. How do you motivate your employees to work hard and become successful? You want the government to limit their pay? Or?
You know, I think there's a lot of, many of you in business will have better ideas than me about this, but I've seen a lot of different systems in use, but the one I grew up with at Goldman Sachs, which we've adopted our own company, is we put everybody in the same boat. We're all in it together, and if we make money, we all make money together. We all got our money invested in together, and if we don't succeed, we're doing it together. And we find that system for us leads to less politics, less infighting, and more people just focused on what's best for the whole group.
Okay, we're getting close to time to close, so I've got time for maybe a couple more questions. Here's one I don't think you want to answer, but I'll ask it. And then you can tell me if you you want to give Alan Greenspan and Bernanke a grade.
Sure. I think it is, easy to criticize people in these jobs, and I think they have very, very hard jobs to do. And I don't think that, I think Alan Greenspan doesn't look very good. But having said that, I don't think it was that easy to foresee this. I think if it had been, easy to foresee it, it would be a whole different world than we have. And in Bernanke's case, again, he has dealt a pretty crummy set of cards, and I think it could be worse.
My question, you think Greenspan would have been better without advice from Bob Rubin? Okay. Then the last question has to do, it's a very serious question, and has to do with sovereign debt. Does the U.S. need to be concerned about the sovereign debt issue as it relates to its total debt to GDP and its growing deficits?
Of course it does. Of course it does. There's if we can't keep having deficits like this for long enough, we're going to have problems. It's that simple. And by the way, I will maybe leave you this comment. There's a fantastic book called This Time is Different by Ken Rogoff. I don't know if any of you here have read it, but he is from Harvard. It is
Republican?
He's probably the only Republican at Harvard. It is, since I left. It is a sorry catalog of sovereign defaults in the last 200 years. And it is amazing to read this and realize how many, how often, all of, and by the way, our own fantastic country went off the gold standard. Used to be you could have gold. Roosevelt said, forget it, and that was it, to give you one example. So right here at home. And many examples of many famous countries, Germany's had, as everyone knows, but there's lots and lots and lots of this, and it is a reminder that this is a very serious thing that doesn't necessarily go right unless you pay attention to it.
Right. Okay, Chris, thank you.
Thank you.
Before Ulla makes her presentation to Chris, I want to thank Chris and his people with him, his guest, for being here today. We're very, very fortunate for Chris to be able to work us into his schedule, and he made an extra effort to do this. So thank you again.
And thank you, Malcolm. And Chris, to remember us by, we have a couple of books for you here, one on Naples and one on Marco Island. And Chris, you're wonderful. Thank you very much for coming. We truly appreciate it. And Chris is now going to head on down to the islands, and he will be piloted by this very young and attractive lady at the table here, Anne Gray, who looks to be about 15, but she's actually the pilot of his plane. So we see each other in 1 week across the street. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you. Thank you all.
I learned so much.
Good.
I had a lot to learn, but anyway, but you're superb.
Thank you very much for your time.